Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A little civics lesson from U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara after charging former traders in the London Whale case.
Capitalism works best when its captains do not lie and cheat.
Well, okay then. And commerce comes to a halt in Egypt's chaos. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, August 14th. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's been an incredibly violent day in Egypt. The military-backed government declared a month-long state of emergency. Buildings have been set on fire, banks and businesses have closed. In many cities, anything resembling normal life or everyday commerce has come to a halt. Kimberly Adams is a reporter who's joined us many times this year from Cairo. Kimberly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Give me a sense of what things are like right now.
Right now, I mean, you can hear a little bit of traffic behind me, but as I look outside of my apartment window, which usually I can see packed traffic, lots of people walking around. But because of this curfew that's come with the state of emergency here in Cairo and in many cities throughout Egypt, there's a drastic reduction in the number of people out and about in Cairo as people are trying to make their way home to not fall victim to this curfew where they can be stopped, where they could be arrested even for being out after curfew. And that has major economic implications here in Cairo because so much of business is conducted here late at night. And now none of that can happen.
So there's a real economic effect to this state of emergency. Do we have a sense of what's open, what's closed?
You know, it kind of affects the economy at a couple of different levels. If you're talking about small businesses and sort of people working for themselves, just outside of my window is a bridge, a little bridge that goes over the Nile River where usually young couples are walking along, and now nobody's out there. Nobody's selling corn on the cob, nobody's selling flowers, nothing. And then when it comes to bigger segments of the economy, like banks and the stock exchange, the banks shut down early today because of the violence. The stock exchange is going to be closed tomorrow, along with those banks, and that is just an example of some of the businesses that are going to be shut down tomorrow because of the ongoing violence and because of the state of emergency.
Does the bigger stuff have a real effect? I mean, the banks, the stock exchanges, because things have been so tumultuous leading up to this state of emergency, do we have a sense that there really is going to be an effect from the closures?
The effect is probably going to be more so on the larger economy and the way that the international community looks at Egypt. After that turnover in early July, we saw the markets going up, we saw exports going up, we saw a lot of things that boosted the confidence of the international community in Egypt. Now, today, the stock market dropped by 1.7%, and that confidence of the international community is probably what's hurt the most by this.
Talk to me a little bit about transportation. The railway station is being shut down here. What does that mean?
Well, a lot of people commute into Cairo for work, and now with those railways shut down, they aren't able to do that. So that's really going to affect the ability of people to get around. And with that curfew, it doesn't allow people to be out until about 6 o'clock in the morning. That's also going to affect people who maybe have to commute for 3 or 4 hours.
Is there an economic normal in Egypt these days?
The economic normal in Egypt right now is just making do. People here are so used to protests and demonstrations and disruptions that they've really developed a resiliency. And, you know, there's a very common Egyptian phrase here that people often say, which is malesh, which just basically means it happens. And at some point they write it off, but then at other points they go out into the street and they protest. And then you have presidents overthrown and different governments put in place.
Kimberly Adams, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lizzie.
It turns out the London Whale is actually more of a rat. Bruno Ixil, known for that massive $6 billion trading loss at JP Morgan Chase, and he's been helping federal prosecutors. Today, the U.S. attorney in New York filed charges against two other former J.P. Morgan traders. Prosecutors say they cooked the books to hide Ixil's losses. Ixil says he wanted to reveal the losses but was pressured from above. The question now is how far above and how high this probe would have to reach to have a real impact on the bank. Sally Herships has more.
There are two sides to every story, including this one. Today's charges hint that prosecutors could target more senior J.P. Morgan employees who knew about the London whale trade. But if not, will charging only lower downs instill fear in banks and bankers?
You know, my answer is absolutely.
Bob Hartheimer is a banking industry consultant, and he represents side number one.
It doesn't make a difference what level the employee is, but the seriousness of the charges.
Which, in this case, are serious.
False books and records, wire fraud, false SEC filings.
But then there's the other point of view, that until you make the executives at the top hurt, nothing will change.
Well, it's quite correct that they're going to need to go to the C-suite.
William Black teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri.
To the CEOs and CFOs before anyone is going to take them remotely seriously.
U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara made it clear today that because of the economic harm a single bank can do, we need to aim high.
Prosecutors need to be even more aggressive. Regulators need to be even more vigilant. And companies themselves need to pay closer attention to the cultures that they create.
The University of Missouri's William Black says this case won't have any serious impact, but he is glad the Justice Department is prosecuting someone. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On the rest of Wall Street today, red across the board. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Soft drinks have had a rough go of it lately. New York tried to ban the big ones. Many schools are getting rid of them. And both Coke and Pepsi have promoted diet soda as a healthier option. But not everyone is convinced about the sugar substitutes in them. So tomorrow, Coca-Cola starts a new ad campaign in defense of aspartame. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
The problem for the beverage industry is that new research suggests that low-calorie sweeteners may not be good for us. Susan Swithers is a professor at Purdue. She recently looked at several big studies of people who drank diet soda over a period of 20 to 25 years. And what she found?
People who drink as little as one diet soda a day have increases in the risk not only for overweight and obesity, but also for diseases like type 2 diabetes, coronary heart disease, metabolic syndrome, high blood pressure, and stroke.
It's research like this that beverage consultant Tom Perko says is shaking the foundation of America's soda belief system.
The real issue here is whether or not Americans still buy into the religion of soft drinks in general.
Perko says that as long as we continue to see a shift away from the belief that soft drinks are wonderful, safe, and pleasurable, the beverage industry will continue to go on the offensive.
And they have to dig in now and dig in deeply to try to control this before Americans stop believing in soft drinks.
Coke's new ad campaign is designed to do just that. It points out that aspartame is one of the most studied ingredients on the planet, and that the FDA has approved it for use in over 6,000 products. But diet soda sales are declining even faster than regular soda, not only because of health concerns, but Perko says because diet sodas simply aren't working for consumers.
They switch over to diet, yet their waistlines continue to expand.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Members of Congress are at home in their districts this month, where immigration is a hot issue, especially here in California. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler went to the hometown of one very powerful congressman who is the target of immigration activists.
Thousands of farm workers chanted as they marched in Bakersfield today. Agriculture brought in around $6 billion in revenues to Kern County last year. Among the rallying farm workers was 50-year-old Bernardino Garcia. He's been working in the fields around Bakersfield for 15 years. He makes minimum wage. He sacrificed a day's pay, around $60, to attend.
I will lose money, but I'm going to be much better off with the change that the immigration reform will bring about for me and my family.
The guy translating is Arturo Rodriguez, president of the United Farm Workers. He's been down this road before, but many lawmakers say that if you want to come to America, you should follow the rules. So legislation has repeatedly stalled in Congress.
We're tired of waiting. We've been waiting now for years. We've been fighting this fight for over a decade now. And it's time that Congress takes action.
Juana Carbajal used to work in the fields. Her relatives still do.
Life out there in the fields is very difficult if you're undocumented. Why? Because the mistreatment that happens in the fields.
She says workers may not get paid, or they may not have access to shade on days where the temperature is above 100 degrees.
If you're undocumented and you want to address what's happening, they just call you and say, you know what, we don't need you to come in to work tomorrow. And that's it.
On the other side of the industry, the employers, the farmers, also want to see immigration reform, or at least some form of it. It's harvest time, and machines shake the almonds off the trees. Greg Wiggis is with the Kern County Farm Bureau and a fifth-generation farmer.
Immigration reform is vital. We want a supply of labor that is legal.
He says tighter immigration enforcement has made it harder to find workers. Still, he hopes House Republicans keep negotiating.
Hopefully the House can craft and negotiate a bill that is a little more tailored to agricultural needs.
Bakersfield Congressman Kevin McCarthy was unavailable, but in a statement he says rather than take up the Senate bill, the House will move in a step-by-step approach that first secures the border. In Bakersfield, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, a not-so-typical art exhibit getting some not-so-typical reactions.
I've had people walking out and like, housing prices go up, woohoo, you know, and this emphatic like, yes, I'm going to make my money back.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yesterday, Wall Street gave. Today, it took back and more. The Dow Jones Industrial Average reversed 113 points, or 0.7%, to close at 15,337. The NASDAQ dropped 15 points, 0.4%, to end at 3669. The S&P 500 fell 8 points, 0.5%. It finished at 1685. Two speeches today by the same Federal Reserve official left investors worried about economic growth. Bank stocks flashed red. Morgan Stanley debited 0.6%. Wells Fargo slipped 0.5%. And J.P. Morgan Chase fell 0.25% on that news that we reported. Two former traders criminally charged for fraud. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. 99 years ago, the Panama Canal opened, saving a lot of time on shipping. And if you're caught napping in your cube, tell your boss to take a chill pill. It's National Relaxation Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. I'm generally a hummus enthusiast. It turns out I'm in the minority in this country, numerically speaking. And the hummus industry, yes, there's a hummus industry, wants to cultivate more fans. So they're starting with sports fans. Always a lucrative market. Duane Stanford from Bloomberg Businessweek wrote about this and joins us. Duane, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. So Sabra Hummus wants to become the NFL's official dips sponsor, which it blows my mind that that's even a thing that exists. But basically, we are talking about they want dudes to buy their product.
That's right. They're trying to broaden hummus's appeal. Right now, you've got about 18% of the U.S. households that have ever bought hummus, so they feel like there's a lot of room to grow. People are very interested in it, and one of the ways that they want to expand it is to get guys interested, and you know how it's better to do that than NFL is what they're figuring.
Okay, so they're actually thinking not just about like market penetration, but different ways of actually using the food.
Yeah, that's right. As a matter of fact, they've got their first national ads that have been running on television. And it might be a little shocking to some football fans to see them dip a chicken wing in the hummus, but that's what they've done. And that's what they hope consumers will do as well. I imagine some of that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but at the same time, they think people will actually try that at some point.
Who's buying hummus now?
Hummus right now is heavily purchased in the Northeast. Sabra started in New York City. Now, other parts of the country, they haven't started eating hummus as readily. One of the things that the CEO of the company says is that in the Northeast, people, they use it a lot as a dip. The next stage in growth is to get people to spread it, like on toast or on bagels. And then the third stage would be to get them to use it as a side item, like mashed potatoes. That's how you can kind of expect it to progress, he says.
Dwayne, are you a hummus guy?
Yeah, I like hummus. It's good.
Do you dip? Do you spread? What's the deal?
Right now, I'm mostly a dipper, but I have tried hummus on bagels and toast, and it's actually really good.
Dwayne Stanford with Bloomberg Business Week, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Fracking has transformed our energy markets and the economy of states like North Dakota. But it's not only here. British Prime Minister David Cameron is pushing fracking in his country as a way to lower gas prices and boost economic growth. But getting the British people to fall in love with fracking is not easy. Protests have flared up at a small test drilling site near the pretty village of Balcombe in the southern county of Sussex. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
We are the power in everyone.
The protest has spawned an odd alliance. These New Age climate campaigners, with faces painted green, joined forces with the well-heeled conservative residents of Balcombe Village. Rodney Saunders is vice chairman of the parish council.
We held a poll and 82% wished the parish council to oppose fracking. And that is now parish council policy. If it's going to take place, we'd probably prefer it to be done somewhere else. Classic NIMBYism.
The Balcombe protesters chanted that their county of Sussex is not for shale. Some villagers may be mainly motivated by concern about the value of their property, but many, like Delia Rosenboom, also appear genuinely alarmed by the wider potential impact of fracking.
I'm deeply worried just because everything I've heard, read, witnessed through movies about this is that there's a massive amount of harmful substances released both into water, into the air, into the earth.
This isn't NIMBYism then?
No, I wouldn't want anyone being fracked anywhere.
There'll be poison in our water, poison in our water.
As the Balcombe protesters sang their anthem, "There'll be poison in our water," Prime Minister David Cameron defended fracking. He said it could create 70,000 jobs in Britain, unleash enough natural gas to keep the country going for 50 years, and, as in the US, lead to sharply lower gas prices. Francis Egan agrees. That's not surprising. He's the boss of Quadrillo, the company carrying out the Balcombe test drilling. He points out that Britain will anyway be using natural gas for many years to come.
So we have a choice. We either develop our own resources or we import them. If we can produce our own, we generate a lot of tax revenue and a lot of jobs. And I do believe it can be done safely. I strongly believe it can be done safely.
His company did trigger two small earthquakes while fracking in the north of England, but lawmaker Jacob Rees-Mogg, who supports the process, says they weren't quite as bad as they seemed.
The level of seismic activity has been less than you would get from a fall of coal in a disused coal mine. So getting too excited by that can be an exaggeration.
Back at Balcombe, even though the test drilling is underway, the protest seems to go from strength to strength, garnering more and more public support.
85% of the people who answered said they were against fracking. 85%.
The Battle of Balcombe could be a turning point for this technology in Britain, says local resident and now activist Vanessa Vine.
The press are watching, the politicians are watching, the industry is watching, and they're beginning to realise that we are not a pushover, and they can't just force this through, and they cannot pull the wool over our eyes.
Fracking will face a much rougher ride in Britain than in the US, claims villager Steve Morris. He lived in California for 10 years. Britain, he says, is much more densely populated than America.
And you have wide open tracts of land where nobody can see what you're up to and nobody lives anywhere nearby. You could get away with it here. You can't do it in the middle of nowhere because there is no middle of nowhere anymore. You're never far away from anyone at all. and it's always going to be in someone's backyard.
Another oil tanker leaves the test site at Borkum. Neither the company nor the government shows any sign of relenting in their quest for shale oil and gas. But thousands of holes will have to be drilled across the UK. With many more protests in the offing, this could be a very slow energy revolution. At Borkum in Sussex, England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
How you'd define a house.
I think house is a structure that provides shelter and can give us psychological security and a respite from all of our daily struggles.
That's Olga Koumandouros, an artist based here in LA. Her current piece, which is on view at the Hammer Museum, is called Dream Home Resource Center. But it might not be what you typically think of as art.
It's got a glass wall, and so it's very transparent. And the doors were initially glass as well. And I decided to replace them with these McMansion
doors. The first thing you see are two giant doors from a McMansion in Orange County, and we walked through them to go inside.
I then bought new door handles that didn't have doorknobs.
It doesn't look like a house. It's a big white spare room, actually, with rainbow stripes horizontally that go around two walls. There are factoids about housing in the U.S., a gold-painted information booth in the center, and high up on the left wall, a big list of numbers.
This whiteboard is sort of a white painting, and weekly I change the statistics because the facts of having a home and having a secure place to live keeps changing.
And it's all part of Koumandouros' goal, to use art to make people think about the housing crisis.
Because we're trying to figure it out, and it's confusing, and the numbers are overwhelming, and I know this is your specialty, but I'm an artist, and it's not my specialty. I'm not an economist, but I'm fascinated with the numbers that are thrown at me.
Well, you are an artist.
Yeah.
I think it would seem to some people strange or surprising that you had taken on the idea of looking at homeownership and the housing crisis. How did you decide to do this? How did this process unfold?
Well, it was my own life. I was completely impacted by this. I was in a partnership with a man for 10 years, and we bought a house together. And we had gotten really underwater. And across the street, there was a moment on my block where there were five empty houses, you know, and it just felt like a weird ghost town in the middle of Glass Hill Park. So it's just been on my mind so much about the stresses, because we ended up buying the house the same week he got laid off from his job as an architect. So we're like almost like a case study of the whole Southern California boom, which floated him, and then, you know, let us down.
So you have a kiosk in here, and part of the way this works, you even got a little sign here. Read that sign for me and tell me what
okay.
It says.
It says, Dream Home Resource Center. We are here to share our housing information and experiences with you. All questions and comments are welcome.
So who goes in that blue chair?
I brought in people who have different narratives and specialties. I've had a realtor here. I've had mortgage brokers here. So people who are actually benefiting from market escalation as well as homeless rights activists together. And that reason why I've done that deliberately is because they all fill out the picture of our housing situation.
What kind of responses have you had to this piece?
I think a lot of people are trying to make sense of this issue and concern. And so whether I've had people walking out and like, housing prices go up, woohoo, you know, and this emphatic like, yes, I'm going to make my money back. And then I get, you know, curators and art world folks that will discreetly ask like a tenant rights question that they don't know about. Like, can my landlord really raise my rent 20%? Is that, you know? So I want that nexus and convergence of all those stories for people who maybe it all worked out to see where they fit in the whole thing.
Home ownership has been sold as a cornerstone of the American dream. Is that still valid?
I love the fact that that is being interrogated. Ownership and consumption is also linked to how much our economy is consumer-based. So I just think that there's a lot of machinations that have gone to this that is so specifically American. And I love digging that out, and I think questioning it. And I think questioning it is part of maybe a shift.
Olga Komandouros, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and thank you.
The exhibit runs through August 18th, and you can see images from it at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the New York Times may publish all the news that's fit to print, but man, that wasn't happening on its website today. The paper's site was down for about an hour, leading to some creative workarounds. The Times tweeted out photos, published articles on Facebook, and the opinion section even said it was ready to tweet out op-eds and editorials in 140-character increments. Thankfully, it didn't come to that. The Times apologized to its subscribers, saying a maintenance update was probably to blame. In the future, just to be safe, you could also just buy the thing on paper. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the program for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll meet you back here again tomorrow. This is APM.